Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joseph Gerson, Disarmament Coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee, who discusses the danger of unintended consequences from Donald Trump's threats and insults hurled at North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Chad Bolt, Policy Manager with the National Indivisible Movement, who talks about the fight to defeat the Republican Graham Cassidy Obamacare repeal bill and the future of the U.S. healthcare system. And Eric and Jason Ramos, whose parents have been ordered deported back to their native Ecuador after living in the U.S. for 24 years, relate the pain they face on the impending breakup of their family. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to Foreign Policy magazine, Afghanistan's Nimruz province is a case study of what went wrong during the 16-year U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. After billions of dollars spent in aid, the province is still controlled by drug lords, smugglers, kidnappers, and a corrupt military. This southern corner of Afghanistan is also a hub for migrants leaving the country for what they hope will be better lives in Iran and Western Europe. To cross the border, traffickers charge $500 per person, twice the salary of an Afghan soldier on the front line. Trucks full of migrants head into the desert toward the Pakistani province of Balochistan, through areas controlled by the Taliban, and into Iran. Migrants face many risks on their journey from criminal gangs, the Taliban, and shakedowns by border guards. Afghanistan ranks as one of the poorest nations in the world, despite benefiting from more aid dollars sent from the United States than was spent rebuilding Europe after World War II. Largely due to rampant corruption, Western money has inflated the power of local strongmen, criminals, and insurgents who undermine the state. In Nimruz province, these non-governmental forces have filled the vacuum left behind by the collapsed provincial government. 2 months after the summer's deadly fire at London's Grenville Tower, former tenant Thomasina Hassel and her son were living in a hotel along with other displaced tower residents. Many tenants were not sure where they would find a new home in a community that had become gentrified and was unaffordable to the working poor. The tower fire, now under criminal investigation, has also exposed the long legacy of Thatcherist economics. For years, cash-strapped local government councils courted private developers to build middle-income homes while public housing tenants got pushed out of London. According to the Christian Science Monitor, low-wage service workers have for many years relied on subsidized social housing as the only affordable option in London, where housing prices skyrocketed 500% since the mid-1990s. Until the late 1970s, social housing had a solid footing in London. But while in office, Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher sold off public assets and placed a freeze on new funding for social housing. More recently, the Conservative government has slashed rental subsidies to local government councils. Across London, social housing has been systematically demolished in favor of middle-income homes, which has resulted in the loss of some 8,000 public housing units over the last decade. 20 years ago, Newton, Iowa was a blue-collar union town, home to a large Maytag factory, lots of good-paying jobs, and a contract with the United Auto Workers. Employees there could look forward to a full pension upon retirement. 15 years ago, before the big recession hit and corporate mergers took its toll, 4,000 workers were employed by Maytag. But in 2006, when Whirlpool merged with Maytag, the Newton plant was shut down, leaving the Rust Belt town in economic freefall. Suffering from a 10% unemployment rate, Newton officials offered a big tax break and their well-trained workforce in the hopes of attracting a new employer to anchor the town's economy. The town signed a deal with wind power turbine maker TBI Composites, a non-union employer. But after a high turnover rate and complaints about poor working conditions, workers at TPI attempted to organize a union in 2013 with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The union drive failed, and TPI management actively opposed the union. The company brought in a new human resource director who charged that pro-union workers were violating rules governing labor organizing. Fired union activist Dennis Young sought relief from the National Labor Relations Board and won an out-of-court settlement with TPI. Now the UAW and the TPI workers are planning a third union drive at the Newton plant. Young told Indies Times magazine that the non-union wind power manufacturer is ironically now seeking support from green power advocates and environmental groups, including top Democrats on Capitol Hill. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea in a speech before the UN General Assembly on September 19th, the war of insults between the American president and Pyongyang's leader Kim Jong-un has intensified. After North Korea threatened to detonate a nuclear weapon over the Pacific Ocean, Trump responded with a tweet that the North Korean leader was obviously a madman that would be tested like never before. Later, Trump tweeted that if North Korea's foreign minister echoed the thoughts of President Kim in his UN speech, they won't be around much longer. The exchange of insults continued, with the North's foreign minister Ri Yong-ho stating that the U.S. had declared war on his country, and his nation has every right to take defensive countermeasures. He also said Trump's insults make it inevitable that the country's rockets will strike the U.S. mainland. These comments followed soon after the U.S. flew B-1B bombers and F-15 fighter jets in international airspace east of North Korea's coast, the farthest north of the demilitarized zone that U.S. fighters or bombers had ever flown this century. Your reporter spoke with Joseph Gearson, disarmament coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee, who discusses the danger of unintended consequences that could result from the threats and insults hurled by Trump at North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and the conditions that could pave the way for negotiations to reduce tensions that could trigger a catastrophic conflict on the Korean Peninsula and across the region.
This is not the most mature action that we can expect of our leaders, and it's really quite disturbing and frightening. I mean, my concern is that we find a situation in which the words that these leaders have expressed create political realities from which they can't back off. Some of your listeners will remember that back during the Cuban Missile Crisis, at one point, President Kennedy turned to his brother, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, and said, you know, if I hadn't ratcheted up this crisis, I would be impeached. And so I think it's important for all people who are concerned, really ultimately about human survival, to weighing in on our congressional representatives, saying, look, the obvious way forward on this is to negotiate. I mean, if you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, what you find is that even then Secretary of Defense McNamara said early in the crisis, look, it's not worth it because in time Russia will have ICBMs that can reach us. And we're in a situation where in some ways the actions of North Korea in developing its nuclear weapons have their own logic. I mean, obviously, no country should possess nuclear weapons, given what they could do. But the reality is that North Korea has been threatened with nuclear attack by the United States somewhere between 9 and 12 times. And in this circumstance, it's moved to create a nuclear arsenal, I think largely to deter the threats from the United States. And the way forward, obviously, is to sit down and negotiate some form of non-aggression. People talk in terms of freeze for freeze, some form of a diplomatic way forward, which is precisely what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis when cooler heads prevailed.
It's been said by our politicians, as well as commentators, that the leadership of North Korea is irrational, not to be trusted, and basically saying they're on a suicide mission of some kind. What's the basic framework for possible negotiations that could be kicked off? And I know North Korea has made statements basically saying that they want an end to the Korean War. They also want normalized diplomatic relations. Is there any way that the United States, along with China, which, you know, has provided vital resources to North Korea, could push this agenda at this point? Or are things too frayed and angry?
Well, I think in any negotiations, you know, things move maybe slower than one would want. But, you know, if you go back, I mean, as early, you know, maybe 20 years ago, Scott Snyder of the Asia Foundation was writing about the rationality within North Korea's actions. And former Secretary of Defense Perry has talked about this more recently. And people should remember that Perry and Secretary of State Albright essentially negotiated a comprehensive agreement with North Korea in 1999 and 2000, which was basically thrown out, not fulfilled by the Bush administration early on. I think we need to recognize that the two primary concerns of the North Korean leadership is preservation of the Kim dynasty and preservation of North Korean sovereignty. I mean, those are its bottom lines. And certainly we can negotiate within those frameworks. I mean, we certainly have relationships with more than a few dictatorships around the world. We might begin with Saudi Arabia, but there's a bunch of others as well. So I think we can move to negotiations. Getting to the point of replacing the armistice with a peace agreement will take some time in negotiations, but you build from step to step as you build trust through the negotiations.
Well, Joseph, there's a lot of concern about Donald Trump and his fitness for office. And people around the country have placed a lot of hope in the generals that surround Donald Trump, General John Kelly, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Joseph Dunford, and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. There's a lot of faith put in them that they're going to prevent Donald Trump from making any reckless moves that could cost a lot of lives in the Korea Peninsula or here in the United States.
Here, there's even a recent ABC and CNN poll indicating that most Americans trust the generals more than they do Trump. And you know, we in a sense we face a constitutional crisis because we've always our Constitution provides for civilian control over the military. If you go back, for example, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you can see some of the dangers of having the military in control. So one will hope that through some kind of dynamic between the generals and Trump and our other political leaders, that Trump can be walked back from this perch on which he's placed us all.
That was Joseph Gearson, disarmament coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee. Find more analysis and commentary on the North Korean crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After Senate Republicans' latest unsuccessful attempt to repeal and replace President Obama's signature health care reform legislation, the Affordable Care Act, opponents breathed a sigh of relief. The third failed bill to repeal Obamacare, sponsored by GOP Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Louisiana's Bill Cassidy, would have ended ACA provisions mandating health coverage, insurance premium subsidies, expansion of Medicaid, and eliminated protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Graham Cassidy went down to defeat after three Republicans announced their opposition, preventing the Senate from using a time-limited rule to pass a health care bill with only a slim majority vote. Apart from minority Senate Democrats who were united in their opposition, a broad coalition of health providers, insurance companies, and patient and retiree advocacy groups worked to defeat the bill. Although the Congressional Budget Office didn't have time to research the full impact of Graham Cassidy, they did project that $1 trillion would be slashed from Medicaid over the next decade. The nonpartisan Brookings Institution calculated that by 2027, 32 million Americans would be without health insurance under the Republican plan. As opponents of the bill across the country participated in protests and flooded senators' offices with calls urging a no vote, activists with a disability rights group, ADAPT, engaged in a civil disobedience action at the only Senate hearing on the bill on Capitol Hill that resulted in 181 arrests. Your reporter spoke with Chad Bolt, policy manager with the National Indivisible Movement that mobilized thousands of their members to defeat Graham Cassidy. Here he reflects on the battle just won and the continuing fight over the future of the U.S. healthcare system.
Right now, under current law, people who are lower income can get subsidies to afford health insurance. Those subsidies would go away. The Graham-Cassidy bill destroys Medicaid as we know it in two main ways. First, it ends the Medicaid expansion, which you probably remember after the Affordable Care Act was passed and there was the first Supreme Court case, it became optional for states to expand their Medicaid programs. And what does that mean? It means that more people up to a higher income threshold could be covered by Medicaid. A lot of states, something like 30 states, decided to do that. The Graham-Cassidy bill would end the federal support of the Medicaid expansion, and it would transform traditional Medicaid permanently into a cap system. So right now, under Medicaid, if you're eligible, you can get the care you need, and that's a guarantee. But under the Graham-Cassidy cap system, states would get a certain amount of money per beneficiary, and that would be it. So if the money ran out but you needed more care, you'd have to find some other way to get the care you need because the money would be out. So it destroys Medicaid as we know it. It takes away the subsidies to help people afford insurance. It also throws protections for people with pre-existing conditions totally out the window. There were previous iterations of the Trump Care bill that at least had the pretense of allowing states to seek a waiver to let insurance companies discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. This bill totally gets rid of the pretense. They're not even pretending anymore. Discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions back on the table. So those are some of the features. You know, it like other Trump Care bills, it defunds Planned Parenthood. This bill would be terrible for women's health. One, again, because Planned Parenthood is defunded, but also because those pre-existing conditions are gone. So if you have had a C-section, if you're a victim of sexual assault, if you've had postpartum depression, your insurance company can once again charge you more. That's not allowed under the ACA, but again, those protections would be gone. So those are just some of the terrible highlights. And yet it has a lot of support on the Republican Party, almost enough support to push it through because of the 7-year political promise that Republicans have made to their campaign donors and to their, you know, the most extreme elements of their party that they would repeal the ACA.
This healthcare debate has been roiling for many years now. Obamacare is certainly not the end-all solution. It's got a lot of flaws. It doesn't cover universally people in this country. And Bernie Sanders and others, John Conyers, have put forward single-payer Medicare for All as a more comprehensive solution to the United States healthcare problems. But as you look at the need to be proactive and putting forward your own agenda, your own positive agenda for healthcare in this country, where do you see Indivisible moving?
Sure. It's a good question. And you know what? I'll say right out of the gate, we support Medicare for All. You know, we want people to have quality coverage. We think healthcare is a basic human right. But, you know, we also know there are some hard truths. We are not in agenda setting power right now. We've got massive constituent power, and we've seen that as we've defeated previous iterations of the Trump Care bill. We think we really have the most power in responding right now to what's on the congressional agenda. The Trump administration is in a position to sabotage the ACA, even if these legislative attempts to get rid of it fail. They're in a position to sabotage it from the inside. And we've already seen so many different deliberate examples of this. So our effort to defend the ACA definitely continues.
I just wanted to end on one last note. How much of a central issue will healthcare be in the 2018 midterm elections as far as the Indivisible agenda as you guys engage in campaigning in 2018?
Here's how we look at it. In 2018, members of the Senate that voted to end the ACA were going to try to end their careers. If they voted to take away the ACA, we're definitely not going to forget it.
That was Chad Bolt, policy manager with the National Indivisible Movement that mobilized their members to defeat the Graham-Cassidy Obamacare repeal bill. Learn more about Indivisible and other groups fighting for universal health care by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Before this year, most undocumented immigrants who have been caught up in the U.S. legal system for years or decades were allowed to stay in the U.S. as long as they regularly checked in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, because they weren't deemed a priority for deportation. But under the Trump administration, many now have become targets for deportation. People who have no criminal record are gainfully employed, paying taxes, and integral members of their communities, now face separation from their families by being forced to return to a country they haven't lived in or visited for years. The Ramos family of Meriden, Connecticut, is one such family. After 24 years in the U.S., with two U.S.-born sons, Giaconda and Franklin Ramos were ordered to leave the country on September 29th. But 4 days before their scheduled deportation, about 150 of their supporters held a rally at the federal building in Hartford. 36 of those supporters committed civil disobedience by blocking the entrance to the building and were arrested. Soon after that action, an immigration judge in New York granted the couple a stay of at least 3 weeks to allow their lawyer to continue to press their case. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the rally, as well as a vigil outside the family's home 3 days earlier, where one of their sons, Eric, a 17-year-old college freshman, described his family's ordeal. He's followed by his older brother, 24-year-old Jason, who spoke at the rally before being arrested.
I just want to thank everyone here for coming tonight. It really humbles me to see such a huge crowd and such a big manifestation and seeing unification right in front of my own eyes. You know, as a son, my parents have always taught me to care for one another, and unity, it really is the way that you want to approach life. Because succeeding personally, it is something that is nice and it is something that is a goal, but to share your resources with people who may not have had it as good as you, that makes that success that much better and that much sweeter. Now it's really setting in that I could count the days on my two hands that my parents are gonna leave me. And at this point, I still need to stand strong, because this isn't just for my family, as you can see. It's many other families in this nation, many other families in this town, many other families in this state. We see in front of our own eyes human rights not being treated the way they should be. There's no such thing as a human being illegal. There's no such, you can't be a second-class citizen because we are all humans.
That's right.
And I really appreciate you guys' support. Every day, I honestly humble me. It goes by quick for me and my brother. At least for me, it feels like it goes by too quick. Me and my brother are happy to take the suffering if we know other families won't have to go through the same thing. We will stand strong. I know me and my brother will succeed for the name of our parents, for the name of immigrants, Hispanics, and just people in general, and being Americans, the true way, unifying each other and working towards a new goal every day and building a team, building a network, and going towards that goal in a positive way. We will continue. I know me and my brother will succeed, because my parents, even if they cannot witness everything they've sacrificed for, I know I will make a strong enough noise to let everyone know I am the son of them, and this is what they represent. Thank you all for coming. This means a lot to me.
That was Eric Ramos, 17 years old, speaking at a vigil for his parents at their home in Meriden, Connecticut, on September 22nd. Next, his brother Jason, who's 24, spoke while blocking the federal building on September 25th in Hartford, site of the immigration court, shortly before being arrested with 33 others.
Wrong is wrong. We had to stand up together to this injustice. This injustice is built upon a system that oppresses, discriminates, and throws away human rights, human dignity, human decency. It is a system lacking in scruples. What we have here today is a stand. We're holding a line for the people that could not be here, the people that were torn apart from their families, the people here that are living in fear, the muffled voices, the shackled tensions. We are not creating new tension. This is tension that has already been bubbling, tension that has been in this nation within all of us. We are here today in solidarity with my family that is gonna be torn apart from me in less than 5 days. My liberty, my justice, my freedom has already been compromised. My life has been compromised. My family is my life. I am here today to bring to light and to arouse the consciousness of the community at large. For right now, this attack on our community, and not just immigrants, is something that we should not stand for. My family and I have been abiding by the law, complying with every sort of circumstance and requirement of us. But I think we hold the law to its highest regard when we stand up against injustice, when we stand up against the things that the law doesn't truly stand for. Right now, we are facing an arbitrary system, an oppressive system, a racist system, a system that is being very, very, very wrong at its core. This administration beforehand and those beyond have built this broken system. We had to stand up and build something enduring, something everlasting, not just for the people affected by DACA, not just for the ideal citizens, not just for the 11 million immigrants that are here in this country today. We need something lasting, something representative of all of us. I thank you all here today for lending me your strength. I thank you all for lending your voices so we can amplify the injustice that is happening to all of us. And I hope to continue to have your support, not just for me, but for the families that are still living in fear. We need to prepare and educate ourselves because that is our power, our heart, all of us here together today. We are the face of America.
That was Eric and Jason Ramos, the sons of Gioconda and Franklin Ramos, who received a stay of deportation on September 25th, 4 days before they were due to be deported back to their home country of Ecuador. Learn more about the Ramos case and others like it by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.